Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I am honored today to have a world-renowned composer and lyricist, a man with two Tony Awards, who is equally at home in academia because he has a PhD from Yale, and he's been a teacher of music for years, and he is a terrific gentleman who has won Tonys for Titanic and Nine. Say hello to Maury Yeston.
Hi there. It's great to be with you this morning.
Thank you. And we're honored to have you in Chicago. And I know you're here to see the opening of Porchlight Music Theater's production of your show, Phantom.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Chicago is one of my favorite theater venues in the world, and has been ever since the first regional production of my first show, Nine, was done by Bill Palinzi out at Candlelight Theater in the early 80s.
That I didn't know. I know he did a terrific long production of Phantom.
Yeah, he did a wonderful job with their... I think those hydraulics are still there somehow underneath the Krispy Kreme, aren't they?
Probably, yes. Yes. All right. So tell us now about Phantom, because there's a lot of young people I've discovered when I saw that Walter was going to do your show that don't know your show. So give us the background of it, because I know it's a unique story.
Yeah, it's a great story. It's a great kind of American story, you know, which is never give up. But also, you know, there's always room for everybody. After my first Broadway show, a great director by the name of Jeffrey Holder gave me a call along with my writer of the libretto, Arthur Copit, and said, come to a meeting, I want to talk to you guys about something. And he came out with this Gaston Leroux book called Phantom of the Opera and said, I think you guys should write this as a musical. And I thought that was a terrible idea.
Did you really?
Oh, God. Yeah. I said, oh, come on now. What are we going to do next? Godzilla? Of course, pregnant.
Okay.
Uh-oh, what did I just say? He said, well, come on, think about it. Let's come on back and read the book and have another meeting. And I came back and I said, you know what? I think this is a fascinating story. It's been about five different films so far, and each one is slightly different. There's one film where Claude Rains gets acid thrown in his
face. Yeah, that was I remember that was horrible.
I said, I don't want to see that on a stage. I said, but you know what? If you just tell this story as a human story, what about if this guy was born disfigured in the 19th century? And in those days, you know, you put the mad sister in the attic, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
We get plastic surgery now. They didn't do that then. And what about if he has to hide on that secret lagoon underneath the opera, listening, and as he's hiding from the world because he's so disfigured, that magnificent music comes wafting down through the crypts like mother's milk to him. And as hideous as he is and disfigured on the outside, that's how beautiful he is on the inside. And the beauty is music. And the beauty is the purity and the love of the arts. And this is now a figure like Quasimodo, like the Elephant Man.
Okay.
And I said to Jeffrey, you know, I think there's something really universal there, because who among us really doesn't feel, despite our outward imperfections, inside we're better, and we listen to the better angels of our nature, and we were so inspired, we just started writing this as a huge My Fair Lady style American Broadway show filled with compelling ballads and telling this man's story, who his mother was, who his father was, how he falls in love with this girl, etc. And God, the world came to our door. Everybody loved it. We raised $2.5 million, which at the time was what it cost for a Broadway show. We had a rehearsal start date, and we were going to put the show on Broadway. And then, out of the blue, there was an announcement in the newspaper that Andrew Lloyd Webber was considering, mind you, merely considering writing a version of The Phantom of the Opera as a musical. And because of the nature of the theater business in the 80s, that was enough to dissuade a lot of American investors from taking a chance on having two Phantoms and going up against the writer of Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita, et cetera, et cetera. And our show basically never got off the ground, which was disappointing.
Yeah.
But you know, Arthur went and wrote a play, and I started a new project with Placido Domingo, and then I ended up writing Grand Hotel. And, you know, it's show and business.
Yes.
And sometimes the business doesn't work out, and you just get up and keep moving. Well, who would have thought that after that great success that Lloyd Webber had, a producer in Texas came along and said, you know, I read an article in Connoisseur magazine that said that your score to Phantom is an unsung masterpiece. I said, well, I don't think it's a masterpiece, but it sure is unsung. And he said, I will give it a production in Houston. And we said, as long as you warn people that this is not the Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom, and your listeners should know right now, this is not the Andrew Lloyd Webber Phantom.
And let me interrupt and say, it is. I think it's a better show.
It's very kind of you to say. We do get that a lot, actually. Yes. Anyway, he put that on, and it was a huge success. We had granite-hearted cowboys in Houston crying at the end of the show into their tent.
Yeah, because you really care about the Phantom.
Oh, God, you do. You come to love the guy. And what happened was, really, it's just an American success story. You know, suddenly everybody was doing this show. It was done here at Candlelight. It was supposed to be a short run, and it ended up running a year. The thing's had over 1,500 independent productions worldwide since then. It toured Germany for 3 years. It's done in Japan every other year. There's never a moment when there aren't three or four or five simultaneous productions of this show somewhere in the round, in a small theater, in a big theater. And what's exciting is that you've got a really wonderful new imaginative theater here at Porchlight, and they're doing this production, which is exactly the kind of on the edge, daring, exciting kind of musical theater that's making them really well known all over the country.
Yeah, that's what. Well, they're up for 11 Jeff Awards, our local theater.
They deserve to be.
Yeah, and you're going to see an interesting production because it's in a small, intimate space. So you're literally within feet. Several feet.
Nothing makes me happier than that, because that's the, and your listeners out there, if you want to go have an experience such as you've never had, you want to be in a small theatrical space interacting with live actors, that is where the great combustibility of the exciting live element of theater comes into play. You know, it's the kind of thing, you know, you can't download it.
Yeah, that's
no
right.
No printer-friendly version of it.
There's that electricity.
You can't email it to your friend.
Yeah.
It's electric. It's just electric. You can't TiVo it. Because you know what? Because you, as the audience, are part of the rhythm of that evening. If you laugh, it takes that time. Actor's got to wait till you finish, which affects his or her reading as well. And you really do feel part of a live process that's once and nobody will ever. It's like a baseball game. No one will ever be there again having exactly that experience. And only live theater can give that to you. And one of the things that Porchlight is doing is that they're restoring that excitement to Chicago audiences. It's not some refried national industrial production of some big Broadway revival coming through town and they're here for 3 days and then they're moving on. No, this is a homegrown, brilliantly talented young cast doing a brilliant new production with tremendous imagination and heart.
Yes, that's certainly true. And I have called your show, your Phantom, the People's Musical, because it was, as you just said, it was discovered in regional theater, and you must be proud of that.
I am. You know, people have made this show and taken it to their hearts. We call it the greatest hit never to play Broadway. But it's the audience. The audience made this show a hit. And not only the American audience, we're thrilled to have it here in Chicago. It's been done in every Civic Light opera in the country. But I think when it was done in Poland, when it was done in Argentina, and when it was done in Japan, that's when I began to understand the universality of a show like this. It's really, truly exciting. You know, one little-known fact is that the great Kristen Chenoweth is actually a coloratura soprano, and her first professional job was singing the lead in My Phantom in a tour of Germany.
Wow, she played Christine in Germany.
She played Christine, and she toured, I believe.
That's terrific. Thank you for that.
In that production, they sang the songs in English but delivered the dialogue in German.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how they did it around.
They do that nowadays, though, in Sweden and Germany. Mostly they perform everything in English, and also in Amsterdam, because so many people in that country speak English.
Yeah,
so
in Europe, English is becoming the universal language of Europe.
Very much so.
Because I've seen a lot of productions there. But let me ask you this. How did you come up with those lush melodies that are in it? I mean, this is almost an operetta.
That's a great question. You know, I come really, and I come very closely connected to what might be called the real golden age and the great lore of the American musical theater. You know, oh, here we are in Chicago, which is, of course, one of the places where America gave its first great gift to the world, jazz.
That's true.
But, you know, the next great gift we gave to the world is music theater.
That's true.
You know, I go back to being a kid and being taken to see Rex Harrison and Julie Andrews and My Fair Lady. I was little when I saw it, but I saw it. And I saw Zero Mostel do Fiddler on
the Roof. So did I. I've seen both of those. Yes.
I'm just old enough so that when I got my start, a lot of those giants of the industry helped me out and gave me some pointers. One of my first shows was optioned by the great Herman Levin, who produced My Fair Lady. He had an office just above Alan J. Lerner on 49th Street and Madison Avenue. And one day he said, you know, Lerner should really get to know you. And he picked up the phone and Lerner came upstairs and I played the piano. And Alan Lerner said to me, Oscar Hammerstein used to have me come over his house so he could give me some pointers. You come on over to my office every couple of weeks and I'll give you some pointers. And he did.
Terrific.
And after nine opened up, Julie Stein called me up and said, you know, come on over that, you know, let's talk, kid. I like what you do and I want to help you out. I really have had the benefit of knowing and getting and feeling connected to some of the real greats of that time. And my feeling with this show is I wanted this show to be a real traditional American musical theater with piece with lush melodies and with production numbers in which every song either deepens the character or pushes the story forward. You know,
in the tradition of Oscar Hammerstein.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of your listeners are very sophisticated, so they'll appreciate this great statement that George Abbott once said about musical theater. He said, "You know, there's a lot of great showstoppers, but not enough show advancers."
That's so true.
Which means, you know, that song had better, we better be at another point in the story when we move that song. And the other thing that I loved about the possibility of this show was that, you know, every show is in its own world, its own key. I mean, look at the Rogers shows, you know. One of them, it's not Siamese music, but it sounds like da 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 da.
That's true, that's
it's
right.
A very different world from South Pacific and a very different world from, and the world of Phantom is the world of France. And French music hall and French operetta, and it's a very French show. And then, of course, it's a show about opera. And so almost like a backstage musical, except we're backstage at the opera.
That's true.
And as a result,
Home kind of does that.
Oh, very yes, much so. Yeah. Home tells this girl, you know, yeah, what? This is what I now realize my whole life, I belong on an opera stage. And you meet this girl in the full sunlight of the Bois de Boulogne when she's selling songs at the beginning of the show, and suddenly she's thrust into the darkness of this world below the opera stage where the Phantom falls in love with her. And in fact, the Phantom teaches her how to sing.
Yeah, and I think that's my favorite song in the show.
Well, you know, it is mine too,
is
because
it?
He's actually teaching herself.
Yes, he is.
He's actually another, and maybe it's my background as a kind of a musicologist that I was able to do that, but as a result, it's a show that unifies acting and song and dance and the music of a wonderland of France in the 19th century. It's a costume drama, and yet it can be done with very, very small forces in a very small theater, because the truth is it's the imagination of the audience that picks up on this and imagines a grand scale of these things, and that's the magic of theater.
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. So it doesn't need a $10 million set as a spectacle.
No, it needs, well, that five-letter word. Five, you know, what is it? Imagination. And you know, one of the things that I think that Walter Stearns is becoming quite famous for, and I think Porchlight as well, is they continually find ways with limited resources to give unbelievably exciting productions of musical theater.
He just did that with Ragtime that ran it more than twice what it was supposed to run.
So I understand, and I think the reason is, again, that musical theater is not a multi-zillion-dollar movie, and it's not some television spectacular. It's a world of the theater is a magic box. It's a world of the imagination, and God, you know, look at these people really having the world come to their door because they've built a better mousetrap. They've built a local, exciting theater that's probably more exciting here than, you know, the 80% of the tired old revivals that are being put on Broadway today.
And I agree, and that's why a lot of the young talent is coming here to Chicago too, because there are opportunities to learn your craft.
Well, very much so. Yeah. You know, Chicago has always been a great source of talent and musical theater. Not only the actors and the actresses, we could name them, and but also the music directors and the conductors and the directors. I mean, I believe your own Gary Griffin just got finished directing a show on Broadway.
Yeah, Color Purple.
Color Purple,
and he's doing Passions.
I think
now.
He's here doing Passion.
Yeah.
And I think Kathy Voigt goes in it.
She is.
Kathy is a local girl she was in that production of Nine.
That's true. She was
Antonio Banderas.
That was, by the way, fabulous.
Well, they did a great job with that show. They won another Tony. Won another Tony for it.
Well, you know, Walter's going to do it too in spring, so you'll be back in Chicago. I hope to see that.
I'm very thrilled. I'll come back and see that. I'm very anxious to see it.
Well, let me ask you this: because people have asked me this, I know what is basically the difference between your show and Lloyd Webber's show? I mean, you've talked a lot about it.
Yeah, a lot of people want to know about it. And I think the best way to talk about it is to say, is to not talk about his show, which is, of course, you know, we have a tremendous amount of respect for this guy. He's a giant of the music.
Well, I like that show, and I love yours. And the two are different.
There are so many different Cinderellas. There are so many different Sleeping Beauties. There are so many different versions of things. Surely, there can be different versions that are inspired by the same story. The main difference is this: there is nothing supernatural about our show, the so-called American Phantom. There is only a genuinely believable character who has a past. You want to know who was his mother? Who was his father? What's his story? And you know, when you start seeing a scene of a little disfigured boy who lives beneath the stage of the Paris Opera near a lagoon, and when he looks at his own reflection in the water, he's frightened because he thinks he saw a sea monster, and then it turns out it was his own reflection, and his uncle fashions a little mask for him. All of a sudden, you bring this right down to a believable human story, and then when he meets a woman who he teaches how to sing, and her gratitude to him is such that she understands the beauty that's within him in the same way that Esmeralda sees the beauty inside Quasimodo.
That's true, yeah.
And she comes to believe that she could love him, and he comes to believe that he could be loved. And he hasn't been loved by anybody since, of course, his mother, who was the only one who's ever going to give you unconditional love. You begin to see this as a human story, not a horror movie turned.
Right, he's not a cartoon or a villain. You love him,
and
you care.
And we're right exactly in the world of My Fair Lady, in the world of Fiddler on the Roof, in the world of How Are Things in Glacamora. You know, we're in a genuine, believable musical theater world, and you fall in love with the characters, and you tell a beautiful, tragic comic human story. You laugh and you cry. There's a terrific bad guy in it, the lady who runs the opera.
Carlotta,
you know, and there are some great laughs in it as well. Or in other words, I tried to put into this show everything that I loved in the great golden era of musicals that I grew up watching.
Me too, yes.
And to the extent that I've been able to do that is the extent to which I think the audience worldwide has taken this piece to its heart. And there's nothing more gratifying than that for me.
Well, you make the case that I've made for a long time that you don't have to reinvent Broadway. You just have to do great shows that people care about with beautiful music. And young people will go to you. It doesn't have to be an MTV type.
No question about it. In fact, young people will not only go to it, but young people themselves are writing more musicals now than ever before. I mean, in the old days, there weren't very many musical theater programs in colleges. Now, almost every university, and certainly Northwestern, has one of the best programs. I mean, they're kids writing musicals and being in musicals all over the world.
You know? You're working with them, right, in the BMI Theater Workshop?
Very much so. I mean, Avenue Q was written in my workshop. And
by two Northwestern kids.
And Aaron's and Flaherty, you know, they came into that workshop together and they started writing Lucky Stiff and My Favorite Year, and they ended up writing Ragtime together.
Sure.
You know, and I think that's not only here in America, it's all over the world. I mean, I can't get over going, you know, you go to Hamburg, you go to Tokyo, you go to Sweden, and you see these Broadway babies, they tap dance, they dance, they sing, they act, they know every song that was ever on Broadway. There's a great talent pool out there in the world.
Well, that's great. And so I love to hear your optimism, because we hear that, and I get so upset when I hear the doomsdayers saying that, you know, Broadway's dead, there's nothing new, it's all been done. And every time they say that, they're wrong. Then comes Avenue Q You know, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels whatever.
I've watched the Declaration of the Death of Broadway declared so many times. I've been so much part of it. I remember back in the mid to late 80s, there was a sequence of shows. I think one of them was called Dune and one of them was called Via Galactica. And, oh, God, they just didn't last. And everybody said, okay, now Broadway's dead. And then, you know, in almost the same moment, we opened Grand Hotel, followed by the opening of City of Angels, and suddenly the critics were going, well, you know what, Broadway's not quite dead.
Tell us that story, because from what I understand, that you got a call from Tommy Toon, it's kind of right, almost out of a script from
you
an old MGM film.
I really thought I was in a black and white MGM movie. Toon had directed Nine, and he was a real pal, and we did Cloud Nine off Broadway.
Right.
And he was on his way up to Boston to do Grand Hotel with a score by the great Wright and Forrest. These guys had written Kismet and Song of Norway.
Oh, yeah, right. They're old-time guys, yeah.
They were both in their 80s at the time. And they were up there in Boston. And, you know what happens out of town. Sometimes the show, with all the best of intentions, once you put it out in front of the audience, you realize, gee, there's a lot of work to do on this show. It's not working. And the local critic at that time, Kevin Kelly, who was a wonderful critic
at Boston, he's a tough one, though.
He was a toughie. He said, well, you know, you may have fixed my one and only, but this one is unfixable. And that night, I got a call from my old friend Tommy Toon, and he said, yes, and this is Toon. I've got a room for you at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel with a piano. Come save the show.
And I mean, that's quite
that
a challenge.
Was just hilarious, yes. You know. So I drove up the next day, and of course, the first thing I did was I had lunch with the authors, with Wright and Forrest, two of the most elegant, wonderful gentlemen you'd ever want to meet. They were completely adorable, and I remember one of them saying to the other, he looked at me and said, doesn't he remind you of us when we first met Cole Porter?
Oh, wow.
And I thought, I don't think I'm in that company. And I said, look, gentlemen, you've written a wonderful piece, and your director has a very abstract, interesting way of interpreting it, and you're not really on the same page. You know, you want the show to go to Chicago, and he's flying the plane to San Francisco. So I think either you need to dismiss this director and get a director who's going to give you a more literal interpretation of what you wrote, or you need to rethink this score. And they said, and this is the old time speaking, they said, we would never be responsible for the failure of a show and putting actors out of work if we could help it.
Wow.
So we need to rethink this show. And we only have 3 weeks, and we want you to stay here, and we want you to join us, and we want you to write whatever you can to help get it done, because we only have 3 weeks. And that's how that happened.
And you had to write songs sort of in their style, but you had to add some songs.
I actually ended up writing 7 new songs and rewriting the lyrics of most of theirs. And we just all jumped in the boat and grabbed an oar. I mean, it wasn't... Nobody cared who did what when. It was just like one of
those egos, movies. Huh?
No,
yeah.
let you know.
The project wins. Huh?
This show has to... those of you listeners out there who want to write musicals, you heard it from me first. Any musical, no matter how great it is really a ship moving forward only slightly faster than it's sinking.
That's a good way of putting
it. You know, you just get the show on.
But you did a great job, because it ended up being quite successful.
You know what? It ended up with all those Tony nominations, but the amazing thing is it ran over 1,000 performances, and that's a very unusual thing for a show to do. People don't realize it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of performances.
We had a terrific performance of a young director named Michael Weber did here, right down the street from here.
Oh, heard about that. Yeah.
Drury Lane Water Tower.
It was just
beautiful.
Dunmore Warehouse in London, and they won the Olivier Award for Best Musical Revival in London 2 years ago. So the beat goes on for that show as well.
That sure does. Well, it's so glad to have you here. Now, I always ask this question, and you can answer it if you want. Do you consider yourself a lyricist or a composer?
Both. Okay. There's no question in my mind. I mean, there's a great and wonderful tradition of people who write their own words, and it's only because they not only have that compulsion to write, or what might be called something in them creates melody. I mean, you don't try to create melody. Music occurs to you in your head.
Okay.
Now, if you write it down and work on it, you're a composer. But there's a lot of people who walk humming down the street. They get musical ideas. They just don't do anything with it. But, you know, you don't have to try to write music. Music happens in your head. But there's a whole other part of you that may be literary. And, you know, if I hadn't been a composer, I think I would have wanted to have been a lyricist. And vice
versa. So you consider your to be both?
Oh, yeah, because they're both crafts. And, you know, my idols are obviously Cole Porter and the great Frank Lesser. And obviously,
I love Frank Lesser.
Oh my God, he was the best. Obviously, Stephen Sondheim. You know, I asked his wife, Jo Lesser, who's still alive, and she's wonderful. She said Frank always wrote the words first.
Yeah, I was going to ask you which.
I said, "Gee, that's very interesting." I said, "You mean to tell me that he didn't write da 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 da?" Standing on the corner watching. And I said, "That's fascinating." Well, people often ask me what I write first, and you know, there's a great joke when they said to Cole Porter, "What comes first, the music and the lyrics?" And he said, "The check." I find that the first thing that comes, because I'm writing in a dramatic context, the first thing that comes is the premise of the song. What is the subject matter? Why am I singing? You know, Frank Lesser said, songs happen in musicals where exclamations happen in language, which is why so many theater songs begin with an exclamation. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
That's true, yes.
Very much so.
Oscar said that they're a story. Each song is a complete, like a mini play.
That's exactly right. It's a three-act form. And Lesser was quite right about that. You know, it's often said that songs happen where soliloquies happen in Shakespeare. But the question is, I mean, there's a great line that Alan Lerner wrote in his autobiography, The Street Where I Live. He said, "Try to imagine a grown man with a big coffee pot going into his study in the evening and not coming out till 6 o'clock the next morning with only one line. I could have danced all night." But you see, he needed that premise to understand, how's that girl going to say, "I like Henry Higgins now," without saying, "I like this man"? Well, I could have danced all night. Well, that tells you something. And finding the premise of the song, look at the genius of Stephen Sondheim, who has this murderer, this serial killer named Sweeney Todd, who comes back to England for revenge, and he reconnects with his razors, which are going to be the instruments of murder. And what does he sing? He sings, "My friends."
Yes.
What a great idea.
Yeah.
So I think the idea of the song and the premise is what comes first. There's a great story about Fiddler on the Roof, where the director, Jerome Robbins, kept saying to the authors, "We need to know what the show is about," until finally somebody said, "It's about tradition." And he said, "Well, then that's how you have to start, and that concept has to run straight."
So that's the other thing, the first song must grab them, right?
Well, yeah, in musicals, you need to know what this is. We need to know what the story is in the first 5 minutes, because there's going to be singing and dancing all night.
Well, you start with Phantom, starts out with Melody de Paris.
Melody de Paris, and the next thing you know, this girl is being sent for music lessons, and the next thing you know, you see the Phantom downstairs, and he's hearing it.
Well, that's one of the things I like about Phantom, is the structure of it is you wrote it in a traditional Broadway,
very much so,
you know, structure. Yeah. You didn't reinvent the wheel, you just made it.
No, it
so
needed to be traditional because it takes place in the 19th century, and that's their traditional world. Although it's a very funny moment when the Carlotta comes in and takes over the opera.
His singing drives
his mind. Oh,
how about his line about her singing? And
don't give it away, but it's one of the great laughs.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah, I won't give it away.
In the show, you realize there are things worse than murdering people, which is murdering music.
Yeah, that's true. My last question for you is, and you've already talked about the state of the Broadway musical, but what advice would you give to young composers and young performers who are like taking on your music and learning their craft?
Well, you know, I do that all the time. First thing, of course, is to do your homework. You know, learn to read, because reading music is very, very helpful. And obviously, take your voice lessons and train your voice. And if you want to go out on the stage, movement is very important. And of course, acting, and take your acting lessons. But I think the most important thing is believe in yourself. If this is what you think you want to be doing, then you do it. And don't let anybody tell you you can't do it, or it's not time. Just believe in yourself. There'll be lots of moments of heartache for you, but at the same time, understand that what you're opting for is a life in the theater, a life in the arts, and that is really the essence of why you're choosing to do what you do. Let's put it really simply. What you choose to do in your life is going to determine who you're going to be with most of your days. If you choose to be a salesperson in a clothing store, you're going to be with most of your days other salespeople in the clothing store and your customers. And some people thrive on that and love that interaction. But if you're choosing a life in the theater or a life in show business generally, you know, how many opening nights are there going to be in your whole life? How many Tony Awards or Oscar nights are there going to be in your whole life? That's not what it's about. It's about every day being with gifted, talented people who are inspiring you, who are showing you aspects of your own self-expression that you never knew you had. And that is the kind of thing that you live on. And I would encourage you, if that's what you want your life to be, don't give up on your dream and follow your dream.
I'm dumbfounded by what you said. That is like one of the great definitions of what the arts are about. Last question is, what projects are you working on now?
Oh, well, first of all, I'm on my way to L.A. because we've just almost finished the casting of the movie version of Nine the Musical.
Beautiful.
It'll be produced by the Weinstein Company and directed by the great Rob Marshall and his associate.
Well, he's got his Oscar for Chicago. Yeah.
And they're putting together a wonderful cast. And then we go back to New York, and I do a show called Death Takes a Holiday.
Well, that's coming. That is
coming
hit.
In.
Good.
Written by me and the great Tom Meehan. Tom's on a roll. After
yes, he is.
Annie, Hairspray, The Producers, and now Young Frankenstein, and after that, Death Takes a Holiday.
Yeah. Wow. So you're keeping busy.
Pretty busy.
And you still do the BMI workshop.
Oh, absolutely.
Workshop.
I still have my brilliant students at BMI, and
so you're
that'll never end.
So the academic guy and the Broadway guy still can survive.
You know, there's a great quote that Ned Roram wrote in his diaries, and I live by it. He said, "Artists exult in their own self-discovery, but teachers exult in the self-discovery of others." And I think I get such a big kick out of seeing my students grow up and become world-class artists. It's just thrilling.
That is great. And thank you so much for spending this time with us. And folks, remember, go see a play this week.